From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 307, recorded live Thursday, February 23rd, 2012. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Curtis Pope, CEO of IsleFinder, about creating a location-based mobile startup.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today, I'm going to talk about startups and mobile. I've talked a little bit about startups lately. I've talked a little bit about mobile. But now I've got someone who's actually doing both. I've got Curtis Pope on the phone, who is the CEO of IsleFinder. Thanks for chatting with me.
Oh, thanks, Scott. I really appreciate taking time to talk with me. This is an honor.
No, my pleasure. So IsleFinder, what is it?
IsleFinder is essentially Google Maps for supermarkets. So we help people navigate grocery stores by giving them the aisle numbers of the items on their shopping list.
Okay, so that's mapping, but it's inside of a building.
Yeah.
Where do you get that?
We get it directly from the stores, actually. So with every one of our stores that's inside of our app, we essentially contact them. We make a small relationship with the store manager, and then we, you know, start that relationship by gathering information and trying to ascertain where things are in the store and what kind of layout they have in their stores, because all the stores are different. I mean, you go to any store in the U.S. and, you know, 9 times out of 10, they're all different from each other. So that's kind of the challenge that we're facing every day.
So grocery stores aren't standardized. Like Safeway is a common grocery store here, or Kroger in the U.S. They don't say, well, you know, every Safeway has to have its produce off to the one side. They don't standardize.
No. Essentially, what happens is every store has, they take into account the demographic data, who's buying what and what kind of audience they're serving, so to speak. And then you couple that with the fact that store managers have full autonomy. So they can decide, you know, on a whim that, you know, they need to move the produce to the exact other side of the store. And all they have to do is run it up the flagpole and say, hey, we're going to do this because, you know, our customers are constantly coming in this entrance and, you know, this is where they expect things to be. Or, you know, they expect the, you know, the baby food to be on the top shelf or the, you know, the very back of the store because they want people to walk through the store. So there's a lot of really thoughtful actions that go into the process of putting things on the shelf and locating things within the store.
And how often does that data change? I mean, if I'm a store manager, how often am I going to decide to move an entire aisle?
I'll give you a few examples. So with the store by my house, they change things probably once every 3 months, mm-hmm. which is pretty fair, actually. I think that that's great. But, you know, the fact is that they just don't have the budget to hire in a company to do this sort of thing on a month-to-month basis. So what they try to do is think of the changes that they want to do, and every 6 months to a year and a half, that's usually when they're actually moving things around and figuring out what the layout's going to look like for, you know, the next year and a half from that. So it's a big commitment for them.
When I talk to the kids, the grocery kids and the people who work at the grocery store, they always know where stuff is.
Oh, yeah.
They'll know immediately where it is. Now, I assume that that's because there's a map and, like, internally they have some document. Maybe it's on paper, but surely there is a master map that the guy in charge can just hand out and say, all right, you know, memorize this. Can they just fax you some master map, or is it all just, it is where it is?
Yeah, it's a little bit more heuristic than that. My very first job was actually in a supermarket. So I kind of know what the internal workings are, and ironically, none of that has really changed from chain to chain. There are some chains that actually, you know, they pride themselves on giving their customers this sort of information. Raley's and Nob Hill, they do this thing all the time. They, mm-hmm. you know, they even put it on the carts. But some stores are a little bit more secretive about that. They don't want their competitors to know, you know, where they're laid, how they're laid, how their store is laid out. They see it as a competitive advantage. As far as like the employees working at the store, you're right. These are like the best resources for finding things within the store. Oftentimes, I know here in California, it's more or less you ask the kind of questions like, you know, where is, you know, the cardamom seeds? And, you know, the person will look at you as though, is this an animal, mineral, or vegetable, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's more like the hard to find stuff. We want to categorize that stuff in order to, let people navigate and know where those things are. If they want to try the next Rachel Ray recipe or, you know, Mario Batali recipe, and it has that real unique, distinct, you know, ingredient that they just can't find or it's hard to find, mm-hmm. then of course that's why you use Aisle Finder.
So in my mind, whenever I hear about a new application, I think you probably do the same as a, mm-hmm. as a developer type. I start building the data model. So I'm thinking to myself, well, I could create, you know, there's stores and stores have aisles and aisles have numbers and aisles have sides. So there's like 21A and 31B and stuff like that. Yeah. But at the same time, I could be generic. I could say, well, breads are on, you know, 3A. Mm-hmm. Or I could say this specific brand of Dave's bread is there. And then suddenly my data model gets really full. Mm-hmm. It's a complete store inventory. How deep do you go in detail?
We actually go pretty deep. And it's funny that you mentioned that process, you know, that you go through yourself, because I do the same thing. We're thinking of things in a very object oriented way. And, you know, when I'm a developer and a designer, so, you know, that's kind of how I thought. I said, well, you know, what are the objects of a store? You know, you have your customers, you have your products, you have your aisles, you have, you know, your individual inventory, all these different things, and you have your categories as well. Mm-hmm. And so initially we started just doing category mapping. So we said, okay, your paper goods are on this aisle, your produce is on the left side, your baby food, your baby products are essentially on this aisle, mm-hmm. you know, so it was very vague in the very beginning. But as you see like more data popping up in our store, you'll see that there's a little bit more specificity as far as, you know, what side, what shelf, this sort of information. It gets really, really, really granular. But we try to, you know, make it really simple for, you know, our shoppers, the people that are using our app, so that they can get at least a good sense of where things are in the store.
And do you intend it to become a shopping list where I would go in and put down the exact products and then you start keeping pricing information, mm-hmm. and all, you know, all the details down to like scanning of an item? Like might I go through my house, UPC scan a bunch of things, and then you'll tell me what, in what order to walk?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because we actually have an API that exposes all that data, you know, pricing data included. Mm-hmm. And the next version of that is actually going to have, you know, barcode information, UPC information, so that people can do that sort of tracking of what they're buying. Mm-hmm. You know, by essentially when you're throwing a jar away, just scan the barcode and it's added to your list. You know, this kind of information is really helpful, because that's just the way people are shopping these days. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's the process now.
So as a business person, then your intellectual property is kind of in two places. You've got the application and the data model and the, you know, the services, and you've got, you know, all the different apps for all the different phones, mm-hmm. but it's also the data that you've collected and the relationships that you've built with those, you know, with those grocery stores. Mm-hmm. I suppose the competition would have to, if they were to come up, they would have to start calling all of these grocery stores and building those relationships that you've built over the last few years.
Yeah, and it's a hard business. You know, when I first started this, I mean, literally there was, I mean, the history of doing an app like this, or even a, you know, in the past it was like, you know, an application that you would have on your PC. Just the fact of doing this on that kind of level was so difficult that a lot of people gave up on the idea. So what I did was, when I wanted to actually build this out, there wasn't anybody out there that I can just kind of model my pattern after. Mm-hmm. This was something that, you know, I knew I had to kind of create from scratch. And so it is hard gathering that data. And so I, knowing that, that's why I created an API, so I can help other developers to essentially build off the platform and build off of our experience and also our relationships and our data, so that they can at least, you know, hit the ground running and not have to, you know, not have to go through the process of, you know, calling each store and everything. So.
All right. Well, let me dig into a couple of questions that I think that people who don't have a startup might want to understand, because I know that I want to understand these things.
Sure.
So how many people are you? Let's start there.
Right now it's 4 people. So it's me, and then I have one full-time person and 2 temporary people. Mm-hmm. And this one person, Janika, she's actually I call her the archivist. She's like the chief archivist. So she's charged with actually calling each store, making the relationship, mm-hmm. and at least getting the ball rolling to where they can contact someone about, you know, gathering data.
Okay.
The second person, his name is Harpeet, and he's a really cool guy. He's more a kind of a generalist. He kind of does everything that we need to get done, you know, mm-hmm. from answering emails to calling up stores and all that. And then there's another guy. His name is Thilagapathy.
Wow.
His name is Thilagapathy. He's from India as well. And what his job is actually on the data acquisition side. So he's more dealing with the product information, making sure that's up to date, and UPC information. As of late, he's been really, you know, kind of forging the path with that and taking that over so that I can focus on the development and design. And we're looking to hire like one more person over the next year.
And you're the chief designer, you're the chief developer, so you're the CEO, but yeah. You're also like, you own the code.
Yeah, exactly. So every pixel and every line of code is all me.
And this is real common when you think about like what we call a micro ISV or kind of a mm-hmm. startup, is that everyone's got to be good at everything, you know, and you're incubating this thing. There's no time to hire 20 people and start burning money. If you can do this yourself, then you do it yourself. When I go to the website, though, aislefinder.com, mm-hmm. it's totally professional. And the first thing that I'm kind of surprised to see is the press. And it's mm-hmm. like TechCrunch and ReadWriteWeb and CNET Money. How, you know, PC Magazine, how are you able to do that? How do you get that kind of press? Because I know so many people, I get a lot of emails from folks and I see a lot of products that just can't get the story told. Is that you and your team? Or is that like, are you able to somehow get these guys to write about you? Or is it just that it's a great idea and they want to write about you?
You know, oh man, that's a hard question. It's a little bit of both. To be honest, I mean, we don't have like a PR company. We don't, you know, we don't do any of that stuff. We don't spend hardly anything on marketing. If anything, it's like, Google ads. That's about the most that we spend on marketing, if anything. Mm-hmm. And even that is like a shoestring budget. So the way that we've been able to do it, I mean, it's mostly me, because what I do is actually I contact writers and just kind of I make the relationship. I tell them what we're doing. You know, I send them a lot of screenshots in order for them to, you know, build the story. And oftentimes what really works is just framing your individual story and saying, look, you know, I got really tired of, you know, being lost in the grocery store. I wanted to build an app that would, you know, help that particular problem, and you know, I built something, and you know, if you guys would like to write about it, that'd be really great. If not, then you know, we'll part as friends, and you know, I still appreciate the opportunity, you know, mm-hmm. to at least reach out. And more times than not, actually, writers, if you really follow a writer, that's usually the best bit of advice that I give any startup, is if you follow a writer specifically, then, you know, tell them, let them know, just like us, we like to be appreciated for our work. And that's their work, is building and crafting stories and telling stories in order to help the public understand what companies are about. And you know, I've been very fortunate to you know, make relationships and tell them my story. And if they identify with it, they write about it. If not, then, you know, it's still good to get in contact with people in the media.
Don't you get overwhelmed, though? I mean, you're the CEO, you're the chief developer, you've got an iPhone app, you've got mm-hmm. a backend, you've got an Android app, and you're making relationships with the press.
Yeah.
That implies that you are what we call in the computer industry a well-balanced person.
No. You know?
You can actually have conversations with regular people.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could put all of those hats on, and I certainly would be overwhelmed. I mean, if you're sitting down on a random Thursday afternoon, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, like today, mm-hmm. and you got to get some work done. You got like a master plan. You got to migrate the database, but you also got to talk, you know, get interviewed and photographed by a magazine. Mm-hmm. Don't you get overwhelmed?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is part of the reason why I'm hiring someone this year to work directly with me that can do a lot of kind of what I do. And this is also why, you know, the one employee who's more of like an assistant, his name is Harpeet. You know, he's so essential because anything that basically I need to offload mm-hmm. and I know he's capable of doing, I just send him an email. I say, Harpeet, check my email, you know, make sure that I'm really following up and not just, and to be sincere about it is really the tough part because, you know, I get 50 questions a day about just our API and, you know, I really care. That's the difference is that to me, it's not really work either. It's something that I really enjoy. I really enjoy reaching out to startups and you know, being in this sphere where I can actually meet other entrepreneurs and bounce ideas off of and different things like that. It's overwhelming at times, mm-hmm. but I think, I found a pattern of doing it that makes a lot of sense.
I think that the passion, of course, must come out when you talk to people. I know you go to startup events. You are located mm-hmm. in California. So the passion definitely comes out. Do you think that being located in California makes it easier than if you were in Iowa?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to actually grow up out here. So that's a big advantage of just kind of knowing, you know, the lay of the land a little bit. I think I only realized it, as of recent. The people that you'll actually run into living out here. Like, last week I tweeted, a tweet that I was standing in back of Johnny Ive, the, you know, the Apple designer. He designed the iPad, the iPod, the, you know, the iPhone, all these products. And he's just like, he's a regular Joe just like me, and he's out to lunch as well. So, you know, it really provides an advantage, just the people that you'll meet and the network that you can build if mm-hmm. you're an entrepreneur.
You had mentioned an API, and not only do you have aislefinder.com, but also you have supermarketapi.com.
Yes.
So you've actually got that API that you mentioned, but it's also an open source API.
Yes.
So help me understand. I just thought a minute ago that your intellectual property is the location of all of this stuff, mm-hmm. but now you're giving that away.
Yeah.
What's to keep me from making like better aislefinder.com and just calling your API and then crushing you, but you have to do the to make the data.
I know. Right. I know that seems kind of a weird thing to do, but you know, I read something really recently that changed my whole opinion of providing an API. And it was a book called Rework, and it was talking about how, you know, chefs give away their recipes all the time. Mm-hmm. Does it mean that you're gonna open up a restaurant right next to them and put them out of business? No. But you know what it does is it enriches their community. It helps people to identify with them and really take into account that these people are really trying to help you to understand what they do. And, you know, the same kind of premise is behind Supermarket API. I wanted to build something that would not only help us to build a community of people that are like-minded, they want to build something, mm-hmm. but also recognize that this data is very hard to find. It's very hard to parse. Very hard to have in one central place that's up to date all the time. Mm-hmm. And so just providing that, I said, you know what? Even if people build something better than aislefinder, that's fine. But at least they'll be using our API to do that. And, you know, who knows? We just want to be one of those pillars in the community as far as grocery goes. We want to make sure that, you know, we have a long life with this company. And it hasn't, it actually has been a much more profitable business, to be honest. The API itself is kind of the moneymaker, and aislefinder has become more like the passion project, the thing that really drives the innovation of our API. So it's really a display for our API, aislefinder has become.
Interesting. So what kind of things are people building? Are these private apps? Are these companies like Safeway that are using this data internally? Because I haven't seen a lot of Aisle Finder competitors mm-hmm. built on top of your API. So where are the client apps hiding of these things?
You know what I've seen actually, this week we're actually talking about actually rate limiting the open source version just because we have users that are constantly, I don't know what they're building, but they're constantly, messing up my connection pools and stuff like that. So it's just like one of these things, like, I'm always wondering, what are they building? But I know, like, the domains that they've attached to, the APIs, and, I can't really say on air what they're building, but, I mean, some pretty heavyweight people are actually using our API, and I've looked on their sites and stuff, and I see like images and things like that we've pulled over. So that tells me a few things. That tells me that A, we need to revise our terms of use where people can actually put on their site built with Aisle Finder, and B, we need to make sure that we at least know who's building what on our API in a more clear way so that people can get inspired and build something that, maybe goes in the competition with them. I don't know. The possibilities are kind of endless when it comes to, open sourcing something or providing API for people to build on. So,
Well, you do have that API key, right? I mean, people have to sign up to call everything other than, getting a list of states. Mm-hmm. So you know who they are because they signed up.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually match that directly to the queries that I'm seeing come across our wire. And the thing is, these are pretty heavyweight companies. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to kind of out them by.
Of course.
Yeah. But I mean, these are some pretty nice companies that I think in the next coming weeks, they're going to actually announce some things because they're doing some heavy, heavy testing. And every morning I wake up to it,
So. Yeah. So do you run this in the cloud or is this running in a box under your desk or, where is this running? And I assume because of the nature of the data, you can probably just cache the heck out of it.
Yeah, exactly. So so we are doing some caching right now. I just met with someone over on the Azure team to move everything over to the cloud and use some databases and things like that in the cloud, as far as Microsoft Azure technology. And so that's kind of the road ahead for this year is to migrate everything over there just because we want that uptime. We want to make sure that everything, has some consistency, because right now it's on shared hosting. So that's kind of the tough thing. If you go over your bandwidth, you're pretty much done and, it's a real tough sell, And so now it's kind of like we've outgrown our britches and now we need new ones.
So you had me right up to the point where you said that you're running on shared hosting.
Yeah.
This is like a company and you're in TechCrunch and you're being, doesn't that seem a little bit short-sighted? I mean, this should be a lot more, I don't know. I just expected you'd have a data center of some kind.
No. Because our data set is huge. However, like I said, I've utilized .NET to where we do have shared hosting, but we also have many servers that, are clustering and, making it high availability. So it's just one of these things that, we'd rather come up with a solution that makes more sense, that's in the cloud and that people can link back to and do different things with mm-hmm. than just something that's nailed down to a box and all that.
Well, and like you say, because it's a giant, largely read-most data set.
Yeah.
It's not like Twitter where people are writing to it more than they're reading from it or maybe equally. Mm-hmm. You could probably keep the entire data set in memory and stay off the SQL server entirely.
Well, that's actually something we're exploring right now is, just we're analyzing the data to see, okay, how many searches are we getting a day? How many of those things, how many are of the exact same object that we can, just keep cached up and mm-hmm. like our staple items list that starts everyone off, that's pretty much all in cache. I mean, that's stuff that's just, transported over using a new session. So, those are the things that we're really exploring. And, I'm kind of a one-man army here. So, I need someone to come in and kind of help me with that and help me scope the vision of where we want to go. Just because, you know, we're growing at such a rapid rate that it just makes the most sense. So, I mean, that's another thing for startups. I think it's important to start out a certain way, like start out really small, you know, prove your concept, get your customers really early on. And then as you grow, make those changes. Go out, you know, don't build the data center first, then, you know, then build your app. I mean, build something small, prove your concept, and then scale it out.
So that brings me to an interesting question then. When did this go from being a side thing to being the full-time thing?
Oh, geez. So about a year ago, you know, I pretty much focused full-time on, you know, just making IsleFinder 100% better. And then, how long you've followed the site, but you can kind of see the progress that we've been making over the past year and just revamps to the website, making the sign-up experience a little bit better, making the UI and the look and feel just, you know, 100% better than what it was when we first launched. So I think that was one of the things that the press and the notoriety and everything was a great thing, but also to be honest, I don't think we were ready at the time. I mean, as far as site and app and all these different things, we just weren't to that point where we could really be proud of what was happening on the site or within the app.
So you did a lot of this, if not all of it, by yourself. But then at some point, you joined an accelerator, a business accelerator called the New Me Accelerator. Why would a startup join an accelerator, and what exactly does that offer?
The accelerator was actually a suggestion by a friend of mine, Toby Morning. He runs a co-working space here in San Francisco. And I think it was a good decision at the time because typically accelerators are where you have an idea, you have kind of the start of an idea, you have a proof concept, so to speak, and you're just kind of looking to develop the idea a little bit more. And, you know, an accelerator provides resources in order for you to, you know, make relationships and, you know, maybe even get in front of a VC or two. This accelerator was really no different. We got to talk to a lot of industry-leading professionals like, you know, the guys at Foursquare and Path, and also quite a few VCs and people that have been in this industry for a long time. And in the end, we just had a demo day and got to talk to a lot of VCs. Got to visit Facebook and talk to some of their engineers and different things like that that you really wouldn't have the opportunity to experience just on your own being a solo developer. So it's a lot of relationship building for me and my company.
But I hear that people who do startups, I'm told over and over that you should avoid taking money if you can.
Oh, yeah.
Do you find that to be the case as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in the very beginning, you know, I was doing this just off of the sweat of my brow. You know, I consult for a long time and then, you know, dump the money back in and then, you know, ask friends and family and try to pay them back as soon as and fast as I can. And sure enough, you know, it's pretty much worked for us. I mean, we raised a little bit of capital, early this year, but it wasn't anything to write home about, to be honest. So, it was just one of these things that it was like, okay, we want to do a certain amount of things in a certain amount of time. Let's raise a little bit of cash and let's just do it. You know what I mean? And we'll try to make it easy for the investors and the angels, and we'll just try to pay them back as soon as we can. And that's that. So I think you should really avoid that whole discussion until you have a valid proof of concept, meaning that you have customers. You've built this thing out, you're passionate about it, and you just don't see anything else but winning.
So did you go out with this accelerator and just use it to build relationships, or did you take money that you would then use to invest in the business?
Oh, no. So the accelerator did not provide any capital, no startup capital whatsoever. It was more relationships. It was more relationships and, you know, a co-working space and, you know, a lot of mentoring as well. So it was interesting, though, because we didn't have to give any equity up. We you know, we were basically kind of the first experiment to go through this thing. So there was just a lot of bonuses, you know, and it was also for women and minorities. So, you know, it was just a cause that I supported, and a lot of people in the community here in Silicon Valley, they were like, well, you should, you know, this is great. You know, that, you know, it was almost like they expected me to be part of this thing because of kind of, you know, our track record with Outfinder.
So you mentioned that you're doing this right now in .NET. You mentioned Azure. A lot of people have said that they don't see a lot of Microsoft folks doing anything in the startup space. Is that true? And do you find when you're out there pitching that they hear, oh, we did this in ASP.NET, or oh, we did this on Azure, and they go, oh, wait a second. Everyone knows Microsoft's only for enterprises.
Yeah. I've seen a little bit of all of that. I mean, VCs are, you know, they don't care. Customers, they don't care either. They're more or less like, okay, does this app work? Does it work for me? I've yet to meet a user that is not a nerd that is saying, what did you build it in? What is this? And, you know, I mean, it really has no bearing on anything. Mm-hmm. If you look at just our app itself, the website, it's built in complete ASP.NET, but no one's picking it apart and saying, hey, it's built in .NET. I'm not going to use it. It's, you know, it just is kind of ridiculous. But there are those people that are completely, you know, they're too caught up on, you know, if you're developing in the hottest language like Ruby on Rails or Python and or Dart even, you know.
Yeah.
It's just kind of elitist crap that, you know, really doesn't matter. I built mine in .NET because, you know, I love the language, and, you know, Microsoft, you know, has always made it really easy for developers. They have a great IDE. Everything else that I've tried as far as IDE is kind of, you know, here and there. It's not consistent like you get in Visual Studio.
So it hasn't come up? I mean, like, you don't sit down with the VCs and have conversations about your technology stack, and do people care? Because I'm starting to get an understanding of why Microsoft doesn't, like, factor into a lot of the young startups.
Well, I think the availability and the ease of use is not being played up. If, you know, from Microsoft's angle, BizSpark does a really, and we were part of BizSpark as well. Mm-hmm. BizSpark does a really great job at providing the technology. Mm-hmm. However, from my experience, I mean, I'm doing all this cool stuff in .NET and Ajax and stuff, and I'm just surprised that more startups are not hip to it. I just think that Microsoft has kind of lost that hip factor when it comes to the marketing of their cool, great technologies. And so, but I think that can really easily be overcome. It's not anything critical. Microsoft is still leading as far as the ASP.NET. They have tons of developers, but I think those developers are kind of in the closet, as the ghosts say.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't want to tell people that they're using .NET.
All right, so my last question for you. I installed IslFinder. And it doesn't have my town. It's not in my tiny town in Oregon. Mm-hmm. You've got thousands of stores, like 3,000 or 4,000 stores. Mm-hmm. How many stores are there? And what kind of coverage do you have? Because I'm sure that a lot of people will install it. Some number will be thrilled, and the other number will say, well, I'm in, you know, Podunk, Oregon, and my tiny little grocery store isn't there.
Yeah, that's the thing that really sucks about growing a company like this. There's only a few of us. And so we kind of have to pick and choose our battles of where people are shopping. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that we've actually talked about is just taking it on authority. Customers, you know, they want to shop where they shop. And so that's why we built our technology to where once we do add the store, it will show up inside of IslFinder. So it's not static in that sense. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that, you know, if as we grow, we're going to start notifying people a little bit more so that, you know, if it is their town that they're shopping in, if they're in, you know, Lodi, California or something, you know, we're actually going to be there and try to really integrate to make sure that customers know we're in your town now and we really care about you.
Yeah, I think that is a challenge. I do have my own little tiny phone app, and I've discovered that the thing that will keep you up at night feeling bad about yourself is the reviews.
Yeah.
Somebody has a bad experience, and you don't even know why they have a bad experience. And then you'll just end up getting, like, you know, user number 1525. Yeah, you suck.
Yeah.
1 star. It's like, oh, what? You know, you want to reach out to that guy. You want to call his house. What's wrong, man?
Yeah. And that's a hard thing with developing, you know, the app stores, the market and all that, mm-hmm. is that you can't really reach out to these people and say, okay, hey, look, you know what? I built this thing in PhoneGap. My name's Curtis, here's the reason why we don't have your store, or here's the reason why, or what's the reason why you think it sucks? What can we do better? You know? And I think that kind of needs to be in place over the next few years. I'm yet to see a startup that really helps that process along by, you know, getting feedback from people that are disgruntled with your apps, or they think it sucks, or it's, you know, lame or whatever.
Mm-hmm. All right, last question. So you're not in my store, mm-hmm. but I feel like it would be cool if I could go to my store. It would only take me a little while because I go there every week. Mm-hmm. Rather than you calling that store, just let me scan a bunch of stuff or take right. Maybe I could even take pictures of the aisle for you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why don't you build a street team of people? I just got to walk down the aisle and take a picture of the sign above the aisle, and then you can figure it out from my GPS location.
Not a bad idea.
You know what I mean? Just basically say, it's kind of a Mechanical Turk thing.
Yeah. You know,
give me a dollar or $2 maybe. I want my money. And I will walk down my aisle of my local store, and I'll go click, 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 click. You'll have my GPS, and I'll give you 30 photographs. I'll upload mm-hmm. them, and then your buddy can build a map from that.
And see, that's not a bad idea. The whole reason why we got away from crowdsourcing the information in the very beginning was because of the accuracy and the fact that we couldn't scale it in the sense that at the time it was only me and Janique, our archivist, you know. So it wasn't like we could call each one. Like, and that's the thing. Like, now we're at the point where, you know, we can really gain a lot of steam, and users want to do this sort of thing that you're talking about, where, you know, they want to upload information, even if it's just for their own personal use. So those are things that we're taking into account on the mobile side. On the website, it just hasn't really panned out very well. If in the very beginning, we actually had a way for you to upload information to a store, but it just ended up being, you know, really bad data, like terrible data. Like, people would put in, oh, it's up the street from, you know, the 7-Eleven, and then they'll put two aisles in, and they'll say, that's all I remember. I got to go back to it, you know?
I see. Yeah, that's true. Crowdsourced data is crowdsourced data, right? Yeah. I mean, you get what you pay for.
Yeah, but on the go. But it is something that we have talked about doing a Mechanical Turk team to do this sort of thing, where, as a matter of fact, for Mechanical Turk, we actually utilize about 100 employees of this call center in India, and they're the ones that do the verification for us. So 2 months from the time that you enter in a store, they're basically calling back that store and seeing if anything has changed. So, and we're able to do that very, very cheaply, very inexpensively. And we use Mechanical Turk, actually, to get in contact with these people.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So, oh, wow. So I, you know, and that's the thing. I just see this is changing the whole landscape of how we do business. I mean, I think the whole outsourcing and offshoring is really going to take off over the next few years.
Yeah. Well, thanks for chatting with me, Curtis. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks a lot.
Been another episode of Hansel Minutes. We'll see you again next week.